You're listening to WGXC Accra 90.7, The Wave Farm, radio for open ears. My name is Sal Cataldi, and this is the latest installment of Reading is Funkdemental. That is a monthly show where I talk to the writers of great books about music, about their books. I am a local musician. I play in bands, including Spaghetti Easter Music and Space Eater and Vapor Vespers and Guitars of Go-Go. I also write about music for Pop Matters, the New York Times, New York State Music, and other publications, Rolling Stone. Today we're interviewing Stephen Lewis about his great new book about Richard Manuel, the ill-fated singer-songwriter. Obviously best known for his work with the band Hudson Valley Music Royalty, if there ever was one. Stephen's written a really fantastic book going into his history in growing up in Canada and ultimately through the band and then through to his unfortunate passing in the mid-80s. But without further ado, let's get on with the show and introduce Stephen Lewis. Okay, here we are. The newest installment of Reading is Funkdemental. We are here with Stephen Lewis, who has written a fantastic book, which I actually had reviewed earlier for NewYorkStateMusic.com. But it's been getting great press all over the place. My buddy Jim Farber just did a piece at The Independent. It's you're everywhere now. And this is a great book. It's about the sort of the band's forgotten man, Richard Manuel. And if you could tell us a little bit about the book, just the title, I don't have it in front of me, sorry.
Oh yeah. So, well, I went through a couple working titles, you know, Richard centric and, the subtitle, you know, we wanted to include the Revels in there, but we Richard's first band, but we didn't, but we ran the gamut from, you know, he started with the Revels, then with the Hawks, and then with Dylan, and then to the band. And I tried to cover the entire spectrum of his musical career. And you know, that's the thing I do think separates it from your normal biography is I really wanted to have a focus on the music for this. And
And that was one of the things I wrote about. First, I want to just take it back a little bit and introduce you. And so this is actually, remarkably, this is your first book. And it's a you know, real masterpiece of research and wordsmithing. So tell us a little bit about your background in music and in music journalism and why it took you so long to write a book, your first book.
Yes, no, exactly. So, well, I've run my website, Talk from the Rock Room, since about 2012. Prior to that, I just did the same sort of writing, whether it was, you know, bootleg reviews, concert reviews, like we both do for New York State Music. And I would just have this stuff in notebooks. And I was like, all right, it's time for me to get updated and have a repository to put all this stuff in this place.
Okay.
And about, let's say, probably around the same time, around 2012, 13, I wrote a piece for Ultimate Classic Rock, just like an anniversary piece about Richard. And someone sent me a message. I actually received a few, but someone's like, this guy deserves a book. This guy deserves a book. Kind of planted the seed, you know, and I was obviously a huge band fan. And admittedly, Sal, it started out as it was going to be maybe like a 5-part website piece. And then maybe it was going to be a self-published book, you know, or I could find a boutique place to publish it.
Right.
And then over time, I started meeting Richard's friends and I'm like, you know, there's this little bit of information that exists about Richard. And there's just so much. And also collecting the existing information in a meaningful way and kind of, you know, putting these things together. And really over the course of, I'd say right around 2019, after I saw the Robbie Robertson documentary, Once Were Brothers, it dinged again. It's like, this guy needs his own book.
Definitely.
Oh, you've heard all the stories. You've heard Levon, you've heard Robbie. And I was like, this guy needs it. And really it just took off from there. I just started working. And instead of doing posts for my website, I just spent all my waking time researching this book. And Richard really came alive.
Well, how many folks did you actually interview for the book? I mean, I know you've interviewed a lot of friends, families, co-musicians. Yeah. I mean,
close to 40.
Wow.
40. And really, it's a testament to Richard and why this had to be done. everybody was just like, hey, talk to this guy. He
Right.
saw Richard on the back of a flatbed truck in
Right.
1960 in Stratford, you know, and all these just little tidbits, once compiled, all became vitally
Well,
important.
one of the things I really like about the book is, like you said, it really is focused on the music, and you really did a deep dive into, like, audience tapes, a lot of tapes of even to his early days, like you say, with the Rivols and his early bands. And I think I said in my review that it was very nicely, you got lucky, you got a very nice graphic designer. I mean, it looks way better than a lot of books about music, and the descriptions of the deep dives into these music tapes and unreleased tracks go really deep. So that was one of the parts that I really did enjoy about it. So let's just start with the beginning with Richard. Obviously, everybody knows four-fifths of the band is Canadian, and probably no one is more Canadian than the man known as Beak, I guess, in his early days. So give us a
That's
little bit
right.
of background about his childhood, how he got interested in music, learned about music, and then into his first bands.
Well, the really cool thing that was kind of revealed to me, you know, there was a little bit of information about Richard's early days, but what was really cool is Stratford, Ontario is where the Shakespeare Festival takes place every year. So there's this deep vein of artistic, ability running through the town. And Richard, and it's funny, his second wife mentioned it to me as well. She's like, you know, Richard had a flair for the dramatic. She's like, he always used to say that came from growing up in Stratford. You know, it just kind of like seeped into his veins, you know. And so Richard, he had, like any of us, the kind of childhood, you know, me being in Rochester and not very far away, kind of centrally located between Woodstock and Stratford. His family had a lot of faith, and his mom was a teacher. His dad worked at a car repair shop. Three brothers, but
That must have come in
church.
handy. We're going to talk about as many car crashes soon.
Well, exactly. But that's kind of your run of the mill. He was a hellraiser, obviously, and but the thing is they would go to church. And really, that's by his own admission, that's when Richard got turned on to the magic of vocal harmonies, was singing in the church choir with his family, with his brothers. And his mom, who I can't, it can't be said enough how supportive she was of, when you have an older brother who's going to be a minister, and then you've got Richard who's going to be a rocker, and they receive the same sort of love and attention. You know, it just showed you how the family supported him. And he took piano lessons, took a couple, learned the basics, and in typical Richard fashion, he's like, I've learned what I need to learn. Now I can apply this to what I really want to do, which is rock and roll. And he left, it didn't take the lessons anymore. Famously, he got the top of the lid of the piano slammed on his fingers when he hit a wrong chord, or voiced a wrong chord. And he's like, I can do this on my own. And once that happened, and he started to kind of cultivate this musicality, he left the schooling part behind, and he started to get it through records and through WLAC, which was coming through the airwaves, out of the South. And it continued. This is something that continued through his entire life, but he would stay up, he'd dial it in, he'd have mail order, whether through his mom or, which I can never confirm, a clandestine family relative who's in the States used to send records to Richard and his brothers. And he would sit up and he would spin these things, he would slow the records down, he would go back and forth, and I mean, it was imitation. Before you can be original, you have to learn. And a lot of red face screaming into his pillow, trying to get the Bobby Bland sound, the Ray Charles sound.
Exactly. I was going to say
And
who were those early inspirations were. George on My Mind is a song that he did throughout his life, the Ray Charles song, the Bobby Blue Bland song, Howlin' Wolf, you reference.
yeah. Ricky Nelson, believe it or not, was a big
Well, Ricky
influence.
Nelson was, he was on TV, he was the first rock star, really.
Yeah, right.
So
Exactly.
he ends up in it. So tell us about his early bands. The main one was the Revolves, right?
Yeah, and that kind of happened because centrally, if you go up to Stratford, all the guys that were in that group kind of lived within a street of each other, or a couple streets. And as I bring up in the book, what I think is fascinating is you got Kenny Kalmuski, who was the bass player. He ended up being an e Ian and Sylvia playing bass with them. John
Jeez.
Till ended up with Janice,
Full
and
tilt.
yeah, and so you got three guys here, that are from Stratford, Ontario, that all made musical careers, which, is a testament to what we just talked about with the artistic and everything going on in that town. And then one of Richard's best friends, Jimmy Winkler, was the drummer. And really, how things kind of started is Richard's younger brother, Donald, knew John Till. And they were hanging out in the house one day, and J Richard heard John say that he had a guitar, and he's like, "Well, bring it on over. Come on by." And sure enough, there was an existing band in Stratford called the Rebels, and with a B. And these guys started falling off, and Richard and John came in, and people kind of swapped in and out. And all of a sudden, we're like, "We have a band." And Richard's family let them rehearse in the living room of the house. You can imagine a little different. We're
Even
talking late 1950s here.
the drummer, when I had bands my mother let us re rehearse in the basement when I was like, 12 to 13, 15. But she banned the drum. She was like Beefheart. She banned the drummers from having cymbals. So she didn't like cymbals. So any parent that lets a whole band, including cymbals, go is great. So the Revolves, that is really where he got his early seasoning, right? They gigged a lot.
They did, and they were playing R&B and blues, to Canadian audiences around Stratford. And this is stuff, this is, you've got rock and roll happening, but people weren't listening. This wasn't readily available. And like John Till said, he's like, Richard was kind of the hub of a very exclusive club, carrying around obscure blues records by the artists we mentioned. And they would get into it and play these songs and in turn start writing their own. And it's really incredible. I mean, they started playing basements of churches, and they'd go up to Goderich, or they'd go down to Port Dover, and they just started to really get a following of kids that wanted this, the way the music made them feel, the way these guys express themselves through their music. And
And it
sure
made him
enough,
pop, made him popular with the ladies, right?
oh yeah, I mean, from day one. I mean, I had people in Stratford telling me, Richard, come in, probably after a night of them doing a show into school, and he'd be playing air piano, and at his desk, and all the girls in the class would look towards the guy with the big nose who's playing piano in class. And he'd also do that at the local YM or YWCA. They do a DJ night there and have dances. If there's a piano, Richard would go over to the piano and start playing. One of his buddies said Jerry Lee Manuel. He'd go over there and start doing his thing, and all of a sudden the party moved from the DJ all the way over to the piano, and it just started getting bigger and bigger until the Hawk got
Yeah,
wind of these
let's talk about, let's segue into that. So how, he was a supremely talented vocalist, and at that time, a solid piano player, more on the rhythmic side, right? As you
Yeah.
described, then, and when he was in the band, obviously he's playing with the genius who just passed away, Garth. So let's talk about Ronnie Hawkins's impact on sort of the Canadian music scene, and then how they sort of coalesced and how Richard ends up together with the Hawks, which become, as we know, go on to other things.
Hey, yes, exactly. Well, the Hawk, for lack of a better term, was the Canadian Elvis at this point. He found that especially he had worked with Conway Twitty, and they had kind of done some they'd pounded out a path from where Ronnie was in Arkansas and Fayetteville all the way up to Canada, and they would just gig and gig and gig. And so the Revels, who were playing these gigs around the town, that it was natural that they would cross paths. And it's funny because Rick Danko was playing in some bands. He crossed paths with the Hawk. Rob, they all. Levon was already with the Hawk, just as a preface. He was the drummer in the band from an early time because they had connected down in the South.
So
But
they
by the time they moved up to Canada, he had heard about this kid who could sing the blues, and Ronnie was a great collector of talent.
It's kind of like Miles
He
Davis in a way,
100%. You know, they had the eye and then they have a vision. And it's like, so once you start bringing these pieces in, and you know, the famous th story is they did a bill in the late summer of 61, and it was the Hawks, the Stratotones, and the Revels at the fairgrounds in Stratford. And sure enough, Richard, who had already made a name, the Hawk had had his eye on Richard. A bunch of his friends and bandmates told me, you know, from the first time he saw Richard, he's like, yeah, that guy's got to be in the band.
And Richard was a
And
little conflicted, right, about leaving the band.
yeah, and that's something that happened, you know, that carried through his entire existence.
Right.
He was an honorable guy. Friendship meant a lot to him, and he told Jimmy Winkler they made a pact that
Right.
if they were to move on, they were a package deal.
Right.
And
Right.
all the guys knew, you know, that Richard had an opportunity to do something here, and they all wholeheartedly, family and friends, pushed him to take this opportunity. But the main thing, and I feel like where Richard really kind of made his name and kind of find out what he was all about was, you know, when the Hawk invited them down to Arkansas
Right.
and the Revels and had them play his club, the Rockwood, down there. And that's really when I feel like Richard knew he had something, because he's playing this music, this R&B and blues music, at the source to
Right.
people who, and he was doing it authentically, you know. And that's the thing. It's like he was being accepted by people in clubs where this was like the norm, you know. And Richard's playing this stuff, and I think that's when he really knew he had something vocally, and that, you know, he could run a show that way.
Right.
And the Hawk probably knew it before Richard did.
Right.
But once he got, you know, it went in the order of Levon, Robbie, Rick, Richard, and then Garth joined
Right.
shortly after Richard in early 62.
Right. So, Rick was a little before Richard.
Very close. It kind of
Yeah, the exact
blends,
same time.
but you know, like a little bit before, almost concurrent. But it's funny because once Garth joined, for obvious reasons, Richard's vocals were there, but his piano playing ascended to another
Right.
level with the obvious tutoring of Garth.
And when, the thing that gets sort of forgotten a bit is his role as a drummer in the band. He played on a lot of band material. He had a unique style that made some of the best hits. I mean, when did he develop an interest in the drums? Was it at Big Pink? I mean, was it before that, or do we
Well,
know?
it's funny. It's funny, Sal, because Richard surprised a lot of people with the things he did. It was the same with the lap steel. Nobody in the
Right.
band knew he played lap steel until he sat down with it and he starts. They're like, oh, okay, he can do this. So I'd asked some pals, because once they left, to go back a little bit, once they stopped practicing at Richard's family's house, they started practicing in the basement of the Kalmuskies. And I asked Kenny Kalmuski's brother, I was like, did you ever see Richard? And he goes, just like any band rehearsal, you know, he'd hop over on the kit, or whoever would, you know, in a break and start banging around, but he never was a drummer. He got his certification in Hawaiian guitar. In
Wow.
Stratford, they used to have musical classes that would travel around to different towns, and you could sign up. And he actually got his certification in that. And so the drumming thing, to your point, didn't really appear until they didn't have Levon at Big Pink.
Right, at
And
Big
then
Pink,
all
yeah.
of a sudden, they're like, all right, we got a drummer too, which is
Right,
just a
that's
testament
fantastic.
again.
So,
Seriously.
eventually the Hawks sort of split off from Ronnie. So let's talk a little bit about that period. That was when they were Levon and the Hawks. They did some recording in New York, and
Yeah, exactly.
so how long was that period? And then obviously we all know that Levon leaves around the Dylan time, but give us a little bit of that little brief history of the Hawks without the
Yeah.
Hawk.
So as you probably know, but the story is, you know, as these guys got tighter, the Hawks, you know, you're thinking you got Levon home, you got Richard singing, you know what I mean? You got Robbie, who was considered one of the best guitarists on the circuit at
Right.
that point.
Learn from
And
Roy Buchanan, played together. And I think they
exactly.
were together in the Hawks for a while.
Yeah, and they would, yeah, and same with you know, Jesse Ed Davis
Yeah.
would watch Robbie when they were down in Tulsa playing. It's
Yeah.
just incredible how they all kind of informed each other, you know. And but they started to get into the more R&B, more gut bucket blues stuff, which Ronnie loved. But club owners wanted a certain set of music that would make people buy drinks, that would bring people in. They
They
wanted the hit
still
parade.
do.
They still
Take
exactly
it from me.
any yeah right. And anything away from that, that status quo
Right.
is like so. Ronnie started to get become more of a family man. There was just a separation there. And the Hawks knew that they had something that they needed to work on. So that was worth exploring, that could really elevate them to a new place. And they started to do that on their own. They were actually billed as the Canadian Squires at one point. They used Levon and the Hawks. They wanted to keep the Hawks for the name recognition
Right.
because they thought we might not be able to get any gigs without Ronnie.
Right,
You know,
right, right.
so it was a little rough for a period there, but for that year, maybe mid to late 64 to 65, mid 65, they really worked on putting their own stage show together. And whether it was soundtrack music, blues, R&B, they really steered away from the hit parade, and they kind of just it was like their favorite music. They played the stuff that they loved, and they did it convincingly. And but they weren't making great money. They really weren't. And I think people were kind of shying away from them being a Canadian band. They weren't pop mainstream. They were more, they started to bring the attention, like they always did, of their contemporaries more so than the mainstream.
Sort of
And
musicians in a way. I
that's
would suspect,
exactly
yeah.
it. And they caught the eye of John Hammond Jr. And in turn, John Hammond had the connection with Dylan and his camp. And things started to kind of, they started to be noticed, like you just said, by other musicians. And it was funny because they had all made a pact that, we're gonna travel this path on what we can do. We're not gonna back anybody. We're gonna be
Right.
our own band. And what they do, they ended up backing, of all
What?
people, not a rocker, but a folky.
Yeah, well, let's kind of go into that. So how do they get connected to Dylan I mean, I know it's a well-known story, but you can go quickly. And then he seemed to
Sure.
like, according to you, he seemed to dig the chaos of those early Dylan shows where people were completely heckling them, whereas Levon split, it was too much for him, and Richard seemed to go with the punches. So let's talk about their connection there, how they connected to Dylan. And even some of the early things were interesting. I didn't know that they had actually backed Tiny Tim on an album or Carly Simon. I knew about Tiny Tim, but I never knew about Carly Simon. So.
Yeah, and so it's funny how this all happened. And as you said, the story is well known where Levon got a phone call. The guys had a residency at Tony Mart's on the Jersey Shore.
Right.
And so we're putting them there in mid 1965. They started there in May of 65. The connection with John Hammond Jr. John Hammond Jr. Was playing blues in Toronto, and he heard of the Hawks. And one of his buddies said, "Hey, you got to go check this band out." And John said, "Man, I saw these guys and I immediately knew, like we just talked about, this was an authentic blues band, authentic R&B band. These guys were hot, they knew what they were doing." And he was immediately impressed. And he told me, if Dylan hadn't had taken them and he needed an electric band, he had full intent of asking the Hawks to be his electric band. So I mean that's quite high praise from someone like John Hammond Jr. So you have John Hammond Jr. and then his connection with Dylan, his dad
Right,
worked with Dylan, the Grossman connection. So Grossman, Dylan's manager, had a secretary or a worker named Mary Martin.
big connection.
Mary Martin was and you know and Sal, this is the thing, we talk about the famous story how they connected, but really it was a culmination of Mary Martin getting in Dylan's ear. There's this great Canadian band, you've got to see the Hawks, you've got to see the Hawks. And Dylan, to the point, told Rolling Stone, he's like, it got to the point where it was like, okay, like I
Right.
get it, so between those guys and then him meeting Robbie, because the thing was, is after Newport, Dylan didn't need a full band, he just needed a guitarist and a drummer.
Right.
So he asked Robbie, and Robbie talked to Levon. Levon gets the call in mid 1965 from Dylan saying, "Do you want to play the Hollywood Bowl?" And Robbie and Levon did two shows, Forest Hills and the Hollywood Bowl. And then both of them, in both of their respective memoirs, said, "We went to Bob and said, you got to take all of us. Like we're a package deal. You need the whole Hawks. You're not getting just us." And Dylan's like, all right, well, geez. So he flew up to Toronto and saw them after their full. They did a full set, however many sets they did a night at the Friars Club. Dylan flew up there and they rehearsed afterwards. And I thought it. I don't have it verbatim, but I say it in the book. It's real telling. Dylan told the Toronto paper afterwards, "I think I found my sound. I don't know what it is yet, but I think I found it." And I mean, he just left rehearsals from the Hawks. So I think even no matter what happened, he knew th there's something here that's like got a spark. And it's funny because, the combination of those guys, it was rough. It wasn't magic from the beginning. Dylan wasn't an electric player. He was a single trumpeter. And the Hawks were this tight machine. And trying to get all these multifarious parts to work together took a lot of work from both sides. And they
Well,
did.
Dylan is famously, no set list. He just starts playing. He might be playing it in a different key so he needed some people who played like 19 sets a night. So they do the famous tour in Britain. And then, as you know, as we both know, we've talked before over the past year, I live a quarter of a mile from Big Pink. So I am on Stoll Road, which is the scene of, I would assume, many car crashes from Richard Manuel.
My God.
But
If those roads
those
could talk,
walls could, well, they're sort of that. I was told a couple of the places where, he left a car. But so Dylan hooks up with them. They after the tour, I guess they're living in New York, and then he says, "Why don't you guys come up here?" And they come up to Big Pink. They rent it for $300 a month, as you said. And it's who's living in Big Pink, and how does that whole thing develop?
After Dylan's famous motorcycle accident, he put himself on lockdown, and admittedly, Grossman was paying the Hawks. And if there wasn't work, like, what are we going to do with these guys? So, Richard and Rick were recording some songs at Barry Feinstein's photo studio in New York. They were starting to cultivate their own music down there. Robbie went up to see what was going on after the accident, and they started the '66 tour that you talked about. They filmed that, and D Pennebaker. So Dylan started to put those tapes together, and the first intent was for all the guys just to come up and help him put this together, this document of this tour, which is what they started to do. And there's some clips that circulate here and there of what they kind of had for like inserts, into the live footage. But these guys are musicians, not filmmakers. So it naturally became jamming. That's what it kind of started to ease into. Rick, Richard, and Garth were at Big Pink. Robbie was living with Dominique somewhere in Bearsville. And then Dylan had a place over on the.
Was he on Birdcliff then? The big house on Birdcliff?
Exactly. And they just. It just like anything great, it happened organically, and they just started to cultivate music together and started to record things. And then Garth had the idea of putting the studio in the basement. If we're all hanging out here, let's get some stuff on tape. And the original plan was no plan at all. And then once Grossman saw that there were some things happening, he's like, "Well, maybe we can make this into publishing demos. We can start, making these recordings count." And over the course of that, Richard and Rick started to understand, not that they didn't know, but they started to understand how to put songs together, watching Dylan. And they already had the musicality aspect of it. And Robbie was writing songs for the Hawks, but everything kind of went to a new level. The workshop, which is proven, throughout the band's career, when it was a workshop environment, collaborative environment, especially for Richard. That's when the real magic happened. And it
Well,
certainly did.
it was so supposedly I guess Dylan would drop his kids off at school, or he was an early riser because he had young kids. He'd come over. The way I understand it, they'd be sleeping. He would make a pot of coffee. They would like smell the coffee, and they'd hear the typewriter going, which is still, they have an old Olivetti. If you've been to this, it's now an Airbnb owned by a guy named Don LaSala. And then they would kind of get to work, and together, Tears of Rage is probably the great song that he wrote with Dylan, and. And then again, as we mentioned earlier, he was the drummer largely for those sessions until Levon came in way late in that
Right
period,
towards the end, yeah,
towards the
fall
end.
six and
Yeah,
seven,
yeah.
yeah.
So what were some of the songs that came out of that for Richard and the band? I know there were like 150 to 200 recordings, but some classics.
Yeah. And you know, the thing is, we hope that those will come out. The band, the Dylan stuff's come out. The band stuff, it's very minimal what exists. Some of it on the basement tapes, but there's full reels that do exist that we're really hoping appear of band-centric stuff. Really, I mean, you can just see how hot these guys were, and Richard in particular, where you've got Katie's Been Gone, which is one of the best Robertson Manual songs, and it's a testament to the material, that it never came out. Richard wrote Orange Juice Blues, another song, Carol in Wonderland just covered it within the last couple months. And it's like, it shows the longevity of the song. You're like, man, this material was left on the cutting room floor. It's incredible, that it, and Richard wrote Words and Numbers, another fantastic song that just never got traction on a record. And all the stuff on the basement tapes, that the later basement tapes that came out as the official record, in 1975, all the stuff that the band was doing at that time, Beautiful Thing, another Richard song, was like, you can see them becoming what they became on Big Pink. You can feel it in the songs, you can feel it in the collaborations, and you can feel it. And the one thing I always like to say is, Dylan gave them so much, but they gave Dylan so much. This was a reciprocal back and forth of creativity that's just beyond in rock music, we really don't see very often. Like this coming out of this collaborative, just workshop environment,
Right. Now
and
it's, everybody's in their living room, sending files back and forth, and no, they're hard to get live drums recorded. But that's interesting. So the first that let's talk about the first album. Let's talk about Music for Big Pink. That was sort of, as you mentioned in the book, his productivity as a songwriter kind of receded with each album. But the first album, he had as many songs as Robbie, correct? And he was the bulk of the lead singing.
And there's stuff like we just talked about on the cutting room floor too, which I think, just as an aside, had an impact on why Richard's productivity declined. I feel like, he was never fully confident in any of his music, and also if it got pushed aside, he pushed it aside, which was unfortunate. But at that point, and there's a period in the book from the basement tapes where Richard's piano, drums, vocals, everything through the Woody Guthrie benefit, where they played with Dylan as the Crackers, to the recording sessions of Big Pink. I mean, that it's like a peak, a musical peak that is hard to match. And he was writing and recording and contributing at such a high level. And I think it's proven by the things that the band members have said over the years, is Music Big Pink, is we it was a true group effort. And I think that also started to decline over the course of the first three or four records, so I don't think it's completely on Richard. But
Well,
if
he
you
had,
take
yeah. Well, he had. My favorite song of his, "Whispering Pines," on the second album, right?
Yes,
Yeah,
yeah.
I mean that, and
And
that, and that was, as you describe in the book, that might have been the beginning a bit of the of his lack of his lack of confidence in his songwriting, because he had this beautiful music, and he really couldn't come up with the lyrics, correct? So
And
that
it
was a
was,
Robertson collaboration.
yes, exactly. And it's one of those things that would have disappeared. And you see it through his career, where Richard had these, I mean, melodicist. He was a
Right.
melodicist. He had these things, and if he was always longing for that collaboration to come back. And those early albums, he was writing these songs. We Can Talk is completely him. In a Station's completely him. Lonesome Susie, but I feel like once things started to not be as collaborative, he was just such a sensitive dude, and
Yeah.
it hit deep. I mean, we all know people that are like that, and even,
Well,
things
yeah.
cut
Yeah.
deep,
Well, speaking of cutting deep, I was going to just talk about The Shape I'm In, which was written, that's on Stage Fright, correct? Was it?
Yes.
And that
Yeah.
was written by Robbie, kind of a sort of a wake-up call. I mean, we could segue into you do spend a good deal of time, because it's inevitable that you have to discuss his failings in terms of, liquor and drugs. And that was kind of a, by that time it was already
Yeah.
quite active. What do you think?
And it, as I said, from a kid, the guy was a rocker from early on. He partied like a rock star, a self-proclaimed party star. But there was a point where, like anything, it became a crutch. And when you have that ascending climb, I mean, when you talk about music from Big Pink, these guys had already been on the road for almost a decade, and fame hits people in different ways. And when management started to band management, when there's the pressure, you probably saw in the book, there's a part where their producer John Simon said, for the second record, we need 12 songs.
Right.
Do you have them? Richard wasn't that guy,
Right.
nothing was ever quite right, and it was all inspiration. It wasn't like I'm gonna sit down and write this song.
Right.
And I think all of these factors, the pressure of production, the pressure of living up to bandmates. The biggest songs the band did at that point were, sung by Levon and written by Robbie. And
Right.
not that, it just, and looking at why there's this decline, there was so much. There was having a child. There was the aforementioned management issues. And if you already have a taste for drink and you're trying to like
Thank
remove
you.
yourself from
Thank you, Bo
things,
Diddley, right? You said Bo Diddley turned him on to Grand Marnier, and I think you talked about in the end of the book he was living in Los Angeles, and I guess he was in the that was a funny thing. He was in the was he in the stable of the Mr. Ed House, or was he in the
Yeah,
Mr.
Shangri-La Studios.
is the
And
Mr. Ed House from the
yeah,
television?
and Richard got great joy out of, like, I'm living
Right.
in the stable, you know? I
Right,
mean,
but
that's
he you said he built like a tree at a tall tower out of his empty bottles. But
was his
yeah.
worst that was his worst, but that was
That
right
was
before the end of the band.
no, I didn't, yeah. And then
You
again,
know?
I mean, a part of it became, as you mentioned in the book, and I didn't really realize that before, but when Grossman lost Dylan, he put his eggs into Robbie. So Robbie
Yeah.
became his focus, and Robbie, say what you will, he's like McCartney. He gets kind of ragged on, but he's the guy who
Right.
gets the business done. And then, obviously they have they sort of have a continuous acrimonious end, and then the band and a lot of different everybody's got their own story on this. But
Yeah.
and then you could see I mean just take it to sort of the last waltz period. By then, he's sort of a shadow in that film to some degree, correct? I mean, what do you
Yeah.
think?
And that was the impetus of the book, honestly, Sal, was, when I saw that, and then you try to reconcile what you see in The Last Waltz with, music from Big Pink and Whispering Pines and stuff like that, you're like, what's missing here? Where's the missing link? I mean, why is this guy, him and Garth, admittedly, but minimized? And I say it in the book, the biggest thing for me is, if you're putting a neat little bow on the band's entire career and inviting all these people, and you don't perform one Richard Manuel penned song,
Right, unbelievable.
unbelievable. And that tour leading up to there's a show that I review in the book, from Stanford, where Richard does In a Station for the first time since 1969, and it's flawless. And it's just like where whether and there's no applying any fault. It's just like, is this Richard not confident enough to do this? Is this he's not fitting into the program of the last wall? Like what exactly is happening here? And to your point, if Robbie's guilty of anything, it's being aware of what he wanted to do with his life. Do you know what I mean? And no matter what he did, so like again, I don't. I tried to steer clear in the book of assigning a blame on anybody in that group. I felt like it had to lay squarely on Richard's shoulders or whoever I was talking about at that point. But I mean, there was no way Robbie was going back after the last waltz. I mean, that's why it was the last waltz. And without that collaboration, I feel like Richard, that's part of the reason why he looks the way he does in that film. You know what I mean? He lost his mates. He lost his guys. And what we talk about early sale right in the beginning, him not wanting to leave the Rebels, and having to be pushed. He didn't
But
want to leave the
what is your opinion on the post Robbie band releases?
So
Some of
the thing
those.
that blows my mind, and I don't, I'm just gonna say they should have been billed as the Hawks.
Ah,
That's the way
interesting.
I feel. I feel like that band was too heavy on those guys, whether they knew it or not. I think they went back to being, and that's why it was like a full circle for Richard. You go from he had done that stuff already. He played clubs in those jukes, So I feel like, and there's no knock on the music. The music, there were moments that were fantastic, but I also think it was the antithesis of everything they had worked so hard for, adding another drummer and another guitarist and another bass player. And that's no knock on anybody. That's just a fact that these guys proved that they could carry a show on their own,
But there's still a band. There's the band, right? That's
And
Jim's band. I mean, that's not really the band, but the good guys. I've interviewed
right.
them, but not like you say, not the same thing. So let's talk about, he had also, I wasn't aware of how close he was with Eric Clapton. And you say in the end of the book that, there were some plans to put together an album, or for Clapton to produce an album by him, or what was the what, and Van Morrison also is very tight with. So if you could talk about his relationships with those guys and some other musicians outside of that band circle.
Oh, sure. The Eric thing, they bonded early on when they first met, but when the band was in Shangri-La in the mid-70s, and Eric's album No Reason to Cry is basically it's the time that Eric got to record with the band. I mean, he finally got to be a member of the band.
His
And
dream.
yeah, exactly. And a testament to that is the album opens with Richard's Beautiful Thing, which he had written in New York in '66, and it took 10 years for Eric Clapton to make it the opener on his record.
No.
And they bonded over drink, over being sentimentalists, being very quiet, reticent kind of guys. And that friendship, as Eric said, he thought it was very special. Richard was available to him, and they were always there. If Eric was in town, if Richard was in town, they connected. There were stories that I had heard about their relationship that I asked Eric, and Eric wasn't didn't know all of them. You know what I mean? Because he's like, we always hung out when I came to town. But I think, and there's one, and I don't think I mention it in the book. Bless you. There's one story that I think is really kind of sums up their relationship is Eric played Saratoga in 1985, and Joe Forno, Richard's manager at that time, and Richard were invited up, and they drove to the show, and Eric's like, Richard, sitting in tonight. Come back, let's go. And Richard's like, you have Chris Stanton. I can't sit in with you, Eric. And Eric's like, no, Chris wants you to sit in. Come on, and he's just like, she's like, no, that's your show. I'm not gonna do it. That night they went back to the hotel room, and Joe witnessed them do an acoustic guitar piano concert together, which was highlighted by a version of the band's The Moonstruck One off Cahoots, which was one of Eric's favorite songs. And it's just like, again, it goes back to that thing, the intimate, collaborative kind of, that's where Richard flourished. He just wasn't a self-promoting dude. And so in and forgive me if I don't have the date exact right. It was 84, 85. Clapton was on tour with David Gilmour, or I'm sorry, Roger Waters. They were
Right,
doing,
the well, yeah,
they were
the
doing,
chaos or something.
yeah,
Yeah,
they were
some
doing that tour.
rock opera.
Yes, exactly. And Clapton was with him and invited Richard and his wife Arlie up. And they made plans that night. Once their calendars were cleared, they were going to get together. And whether it was interpreting Ray Charles songs, or whether it was originals, or maybe it was just co-writing together, they were going to do something. And unfortunately, like I said in the book, and Eric said, time, it just didn't happen. Time came between
Well,
them.
Clapton was a very tour-heavy guy. Still, I mean, I think he's still kind of sort of out there. But then, obviously, Richard does pass away. He takes his life while, and that really was he had gotten off alcohol for a while, and then he, the way you describe it, he fell back in and just was too weak to do that. And that was when 86 he passed away.
And
80.
yeah, in March, March 4th of 86. And the thing is, with the drinking, it was one of these things. You know what I mean? He would break free, and for a while, there's a really astute observation by John Sebastian, who was friends with Richard. And
See
he's
him
like,
at the
Richard,
coffee shop all the time.
exactly. And him and Richard loved each other, same like him and Eric. And he said to me, Richard wasn't drinking. He'd come up to the house and we'd light a joint and we'd talk music. And he's like, he's in a great place. But I think what happened was, Richard came so close to death and I don't want to play psychiatrist here, but he came so close to death. And he knew that if he went back to the bottle, it was like, what's going to happen? I'm done either way. And then you exasperate that issue with the things I outlined in the book, the
Well,
depression,
yeah,
the
depression, financial issues, I'm assuming at
financial,
that time.
not being a
And
good dad,
guilt, exactly. That was a big
guilt,
one. But
everything.
let's leave this on a high note, So
Yes, love, yes.
let's talk about some of the music. If people have not really dug that deeply into on what would be some of the classic tracks that you think people should listen to, and maybe some of the deep cuts that people may not know about, even things that you found some great stuff, some of these great club gig tapes and things that you've discussed,
Yeah.
which sound fantastic.
And I'm hopeful that something musical is going to come of this. I found some stuff. We know there's other tapes that exist. We'd like to source them. And I say we, the estate, because there needs to be a collection here. And one of the narratives, Sal, that I tried to dispel with the book is that Richard stopped writing music. And I think, as you probably know reading the book, that never was the case. And so there's stuff that exists there. But starting right from the beginning, I think you have to listen to these Hawks singles. He Don't Love You and He'll Break Your Heart. They released that as a B-side in 64, in 65 in the States. That I find is the Hawks at their finest. It's got everything you want from the band, and you've got the best early manual vocals that you could ask for. I mean, it's Beak in all his glory. There's a lot of bootlegs that circulate, and there's a lot more I know that exist that we hope we can find. But finding those Hawks performances when you got 20 songs and Richard's singing 16 of them, and if you can track down the 65 shows, there's a Dallas show, there's a Fond du Lac Club show in Arkansas, that all these are all floating around. That's
That's a
really.
very exciting part of the book to read, like just it's a part of the book that really makes my imagination go because you describe it so well, even
Oh,
though
thank
it's not audio, you almost
you. No, I appreciate that,
So
man. And
that I actually through this book I had actually really never listened to Moondog Matinee, and I kind of took a liking to all those old chestnuts that they covered,
right. And
Right.
you know what? So they needed to, as you know in the book, they needed to kickstart their creativity. So they went back to the Hawks. And and Richard's like, oh, this is home. Like, here we go. I'll sing The Great Pretender better than anybody. So to your point, that when you go through the band though, like that's That's a great one. Richard does a lot of Moondog Matinee.
Right.
But I mean, you got a Jawbone and Whispering Pines off the Brown album. Richard, to Levon's point, and it's obvious when you really deep dive Richard's abilities and his aesthetic. That song, those jumpy riffs, those time changes, those shifts, that's Richard, man. That's what he was all about. So I think Jawbone is a really killer track. If you're a band fan, you obviously know that one. But if you're, digging into Richard, you got to go Whispering Pines and Jawbone. And obviously we already talked about Tears of Rage. I mean, doesn't get much better than that. And but going deep cut, and I played this on a local Rochester radio show a couple weeks ago, is the Tom Petty cut, Best of Ever.
Right, or something. Yeah, great.
Man, and again, it's a testament to Robbie knowing what he had in Richard post band. When he did a soundtrack song or produced a song for somebody else, he called Richard. Between Trains, that's Richard's vocal on there. The Petty song, that's Richard's vocal on there. And I think that song just does something. When you hear it, kind of sums up everything about the guy, about Richard, because when he pops in that vocal with Petty, and you're just like, it takes the song to a place that just never existed before, and that was his real gift.
Well,
And
well, we're going to wrap it up now. I want to thank you, congratulate you on the book. We've been talking about this about a year and a half. I think you sent me something saying I'm writing this book, and through our mutual editor Pete Mason, the long suffering Pete Mason.
yes,
By the time
Pete.
this comes out, you will be a lot. I know you're doing a lot of book readings and things like that. But tell us again the title of the book, publisher, and where it can be found.
Yes, so you can well, it's going to be out next Tuesday, but you can pre-order it on Amazon, Barnes and Noble. Richard Manuel, his life and music from the Hawks to Bob Dylan to the band. And my page, Talk from the Rock Room, I have a Richard Manuel centric thing with all the blurbs, reviews, events. Keep it updated.
Great.
I love to talk, obviously, about Richard. So anybody can shoot me an email. I love to answer. I love to get into a discourse
And
about
are you going to
music.
be coming up here? You should go to the Golden Notebook. Have you talked to them in Woodstock?
We're working on that.
Yeah,
I
you
guess
got
right
to
now,
come up to here. You got to come up
yeah,
here. Yeah.
I'm trying to. And once they get a venue, I guess they're working on
Yeah,
a library.
there's a library, there's also the mountain view. There's a lot of places, but you'll
Yeah.
get that done and we'll see you here. But thanks
Oh, I'd
again so
love to.
much. Congratulations. Great book. And really just will I think help a new generation of not only fans but performers. That's how these people's careers get the attention they deserve when young artists kind of latch
Yes.
on cast light on things that their parents didn't appreciate enough. That's basically the business at this stage. So thank you so much, and
Thank you,
the book
Snell.
is Richard Emanuel. Ciao.